The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. It's very nice to see you all. Thanks for coming. And you can't really summarize an encyclopedia. And you can't really tell what the plot is or what its main themes are. So many of the things that you would ordinarily do if you were trying to introduce a book, you can't do with an encyclopedia. But one thing you can do in thinking about encyclopedias is think a little bit about how they came to exist, how they came to be, how this particular one came to be, how encyclopedias in general came to be, and to say just a little bit about what I think the significance is of the creation of encyclopedias in the present age. It's probably not worthwhile trying to decide what was the first encyclopedia. There have been things like encyclopedias for a very long time. Think of Pliny's Natural History, written in the first century, which was used as a work of reference right up for the next millennium, for more than 1,000 years. That's a very important one in the classical West. The Chinese have been making encyclopedias for a very long time. There's the most famous and still probably the largest encyclopedia in the world, at least in print, was made in the early 15th century in China under the Yongle emperor. There's a very, very famous, in its day, encyclopedia in Arabic, which Ibn Khaldun, well, if you read what it says in the encyclopedias, it says Ibn Khaldun wrote it in 1377. I imagine that he did a little bit of research before he settled down to write it. It's a kind of introduction to the history of the world. And throughout the Middle Ages, there was a very important book that was used as a kind of reference work by people, by Isidore of Seville. It was written in the 7th century in Spain, called the Etymologiae, which, as you can guess from its title, tried to explain things by talking about the etymologies of their names. So that was a very important enterprise. So there are all these things you can look, as I say, Chinese, Arabic, Latin. There are Greek encyclopedias. And the word encyclopedia itself is actually a relatively late invention. The books I've just mentioned, the word encyclopedia wasn't used to describe them, as I say. Isidore of Seville's was called the Etymologia. Pliny's was called his Natural History. And the Ibn Khaldun's is called something, I think it's the Muqaddimu or something like that, but I don't know Arabic. But the word encyclopedia is a kind of pseudo-classical derivation, and it means kind of all-round education. And that's really what the idea was of the first modern encyclopedias. In English, there's Chambers Chambers, actually it wasn't called Encyclopedia, it was called Chambers Cyclopedia, but it's the same idea, right? Cyclopedia, learning, all-round learning. And it was that in English encyclopedia, actually, that encyclopedia in English, that inspired what many people probably think of as the first great Western encyclopedia of modernity, which is the Encyclopédie of Diderot and D'Alembert, appeared between about 1750, actually 1751, and 1772. That encyclopedia is one in many ways that many people look back to. And, of course, 1751 to 1772 is the height of the European Enlightenment, and the Encyclopédie, is a kind of, in a way, a kind of statement of Enlightenment principles. For our purposes, it's interesting to think about what that encyclopedia said about Africa. What's interesting about it is that Encyclopedias are composed of articles, and the way that they, unlike the ancient encyclopedias, Pliny wrote all of the natural history, Isidore of Seville wrote all of the Etymologiae, Ibn Khaldun wrote all of his outline of universal history. Unlike those, the principle that generated the new encyclopedias of the Enlightenment was that you sent out bits of it, you made a big list of things you wanted written about, and you sent out bits of it to different people, to different experts. Diderot focused on the mathematical parts of his own encyclopedia, but other people wrote other articles. And the result is that you get a kind of cyclopedia, you get an all-round learning, you also get a variety of perspectives. And one of the interesting things about Diderot and D'Alembert's encyclopedia is that it doesn't have a consistent attitude to Africa. So, for example, the article on the slave trade, which I think was written by somebody called the Chevalier de Jaucourt, but that's my memory, and my memory is increasingly unreliable as I grow older. That article is a kind of attack on slavery, basically. It says things like, if this system can be justified, then anything can be justified morally. Whereas the article on the Negro, the article which is called Nègre, is very, very objective about the slave trade. It doesn't take a moral tone, and it's a bit like actually Pliny's Natural History. So that when it talks about the Negro, it says, for example, that the hair of Negroes is comme de la laine frisée, like frizzy wool, or sort of crinkly wool. So it's very much a description in a kind of objective mode. Well, as I say, this encyclopedia was inspired by the spirit of the Enlightenment. The result is, of course, that the Jesuits tried to have it closed down because it was too free-thinking. And France, of course, was a Catholic society. So when the Jesuits and the bishops of the Catholic Church were against something, that meant something. So they actually tried to shut it down a couple of times. But one other response in the European Enlightenment to the kind of free-thinkingness of the encyclopedia was to be what's probably now the most famous encyclopedia in the world, namely the Encyclopedia Britannica, which was started in Scotland about a decade, well, in 1768, so about when the encyclopedia was winding down, because it was done by 1772. And part of the spirit that lay behind that was to do an encyclopedia, but one that was more, even though it was an Enlightenment encyclopedia, it was a little less of this dubious religious stuff that was associated with the French Enlightenment. And there's something of an irony in the fact that the Encyclopedia Britannica was a response to the Encyclopédie, because the Encyclopédie itself began as a translation of Chambers' Cyclopedia from English into French. So it kind of came full circle. Anyway, by the time the Encyclopedia Britannica and the Encyclopédie come into existence, there's a kind of basic pattern. You have, first of all, it's alphabetical. The articles have titles, and then they're put in alphabetical order. In the Encyclopedia Britannica, the things were originally organized. It was actually published in a serial form, so you bought it, you know, for whatever. Each volume was bought separately, and when you got all 100, you could have them bound into a few volumes. But they were organized with sort of broad subjects, and then sub-organized into dictionary order entries on those subjects. And that form of the encyclopedia was essentially the form that we enter the 19th century with, and it's the form in which the Encyclopedia Britannica basically stayed until it was radically reorganized eventually, I think in the 80s, by Charles Van Doren, whom those of you who watched that movie will know of as the guy who was involved with the scandal about, what was that show called on television? Do you know what I'm talking about? The quiz show, exactly. Thank you. There's more evidence of the state of my memory. Anyway, so now, One thing that the encyclopedias of the Enlightenment show us is that as new learning is developing, an attempt to kind of encapsulate it all can be a useful exercise. And there's a great deal of... So there is a great deal of material about Africa in all these encyclopedias, but, of course, it's limited. And one of the main reasons it's limited is that modern, serious, scholarly, extensive study of Africa is really the product of the last 50 or so years. Modern historical studies of Africa, like everything I'm going to say, should have a footnote that says, except Dr. Du Bois. So W.B. Du Bois wrote a Harvard dissertation that had to do with African history. It was on the suppression of the African slave trade. And that actually was number one in the Harvard History Library series. So it's kind of one of the... It's not only the first kind of scientific historical study by an American scholar of an African topic, but it's also the first in the first Harvard dissertation in history to be published in this great series. But really what happened, the important breakthroughs in the development of our knowledge about Africa occurred in the 1960s, and not coincidentally, they occurred, they began at the time of the decolonization of Africa. And they began in part as a response by academics who were excited by the fact that Africa, new and exciting things seemed to be going on in Africa, in part by the response of African scholars themselves as new universities were developed, as countries became independent. Centers for African Studies were developed at places like Ibadan in Nigeria or Legon in Ghana, these universities. And so from the 1960s on, serious historical study of Africa in the modern scientific way occurs in the European Academy, in the North American Academy, and in the growing African Academy. And, of course, at the same time, again in response to a political event, namely, or political process, namely the civil rights movement, there's a growing interest in the scientific and serious study of African-American history. Though, again, there are clear antecedents to the work that began in the 60s in the work of scholars like Dr. Du Bois, E. Franklin Frazier, and so on, Rayford Logan, the great African-American historians of the early 20th century. But again, there's this huge explosion of knowledge. So in the course of the 20th century, then, we go from a situation where in the Western Academy there's just huge gaps in knowledge, basic knowledge about Africa, about the history of the continent, about who's there, about the languages, to a situation at the end of the 20th century where there's a vast library of knowledge, where the languages have all been mapped and their historical relationships have been studied and understood, where the sort of fundamental geographical situation over the long haul is understood, so we now can draw maps of where the boundary of the Sahara has been for the last few thousand years, and so on, using modern techniques of studying these questions. So we have just we go from a vast amount of modern style scientific knowledge to a vast amount of modern style scientific knowledge from not very much. Nevertheless, it would be very misleading to suggest that representation of the knowledge within our scholarly regimes, within our scholarly schemes of knowledge, means that there wasn't knowledge before. Because, of course, that scholarly knowledge had to be produced by people doing, for example, oral histories of African societies, which is something that begins in a serious way as a scientific matter in the 1960s. To use oral history, there have to be the people in the cultures who know the stuff to tell you. You can't do oral history unless you can go to people and ask them what went on here. And amazingly, they can tell you in pre-literate societies and societies without extensive literacy, very often people can tell you a lot. They have systematic methods for storing information about the past and transmitting it. They have specialists, families, often associated within a family. The family itself will pass down family information, but around royal families you get specialists who live near the palace, and they pass it on, father to son, sometimes father to nephew, sometimes mother to daughter. They pass on what they know. And one of the interesting things that was discovered in the 1960s was that you would go to, say, somewhere in former Zaire, in the Central Africa, and you would start collecting oral histories, and you would write stuff down, and they would suggest that certain things went on, say, in the 17th century. And then you would go and look in the archives of the Portuguese archives in Lisbon, because Angola, next to Zaire, was a Portuguese colony from part of the Portuguese Empire from very early on. And you would discover in the written records evidence that what these guys were remembering from 300 years ago was actually true. They remembered the other side of the story, but you could confirm part of the story by looking in written archives. And so one of the things that happened in the 1960s is that African historians showed that oral history could be used to do history, that it wasn't just myths about the past, that there were actual, these were usable sources for trying to understand the African past. The other things happened in the 1960s, the beginnings of modern archaeology in Africa, and again, using... And archaeology is a challenging thing to do in a continent with the climate of Africa, of tropical Africa, because not a lot of stuff survives in tropical soils. In the deserts, in the Sahara, we have access to 500-year-old documents that survive because it's dry. If you would put those documents in the forests, they would be gone by now. They would have rotted away. So, again, there are special challenges to doing archaeology in tropical Africa, but people figured it out. And now, again, we have rich understandings of the African past in the 19th and 18th and 17th and 16th and 15th and 14th centuries, going back to the ancient world, based in part on archaeological knowledge. And... I mentioned languages. One thing you can do if you're trying to trace the historical relations of peoples to figure out who was where when is to look at the linguistic relations of languages. So we know, for example, partly by inference from the relationships among languages, that the Bantu migration, which populated much of Central and Southern Africa, began sometime in the late part of the first millennium before Christ, so 1-200 BC, something like that, and that these people, these iron-smelting agriculturalists, moved through the forests where there were people who were not agriculturalists and didn't have iron technology, and they didn't use the iron to conquer them with spears. They outcompeted them by using the iron in agriculture, and they spread south. And so now the languages from Cameroon, where they roughly seem to have started from, all the way down to Zululand, and those languages are all related, and they're all related because their ancestors were related, and the languages, by studying the relations among the languages, you can infer where people were, where people's ancestors came from. And now, in the last few years, we have added to this technique for studying the historical movement of peoples, this linguistic technique, we've added new genomic techniques, and now we can study the genomic relatedness of peoples in different parts of the continent, and we can use that to figure out again where their ancestors came from. And so now we have a very detailed picture of historical migrations and movements of people over the continent over the last few thousand years, derived from these new techniques, which you had to use because you didn't have the significant indigenous archive of writing that you had for doing European history in the same period. Now, I shouldn't let it go without notice, of course, that there are important written archives in Africa. There's ancient writing, obviously, in North Africa, in Egypt, and on the tombs of the pharaohs and so on, and in the documents in those tombs. And there are many long-established texts in Gurs, in Ethiopia, which is a place that I like to remind people that has been Christian since hundreds of years before the Irish were converted by St. Patrick because the Christ's apostles arrived in Ethiopia, or at least people influenced by Christ's apostles arrived in Ethiopia very, very early on, and there's been Christians in Ethiopia since the first century of the... Well, you don't need me to tell you that it's the first century after Christ. But what's interesting, I think, about Africa, and what's been interesting in this huge explosion of knowledge in the last 50 years, is that people, these scholars, African scholars and African-American scholars and European and North American white scholars from many places, inspired by the excitement of what was going on in Africa, went in and figured out things using new techniques, because the old techniques, which had been developed for European historical work, couldn't be used in places where you didn't have the same kinds of archives and the same kinds of evidence. And they showed that with the evidence that there was, you could, in fact, reconstruct a very rich picture of the African past. In the same period of since the 60s, there's been a massive growth, both in modern scholarship about Africa, but also in modern fiction. Africans have written novels in huge numbers since the Second World War, and published them in both in the major colonial languages, in Portuguese and French and English, in Arabic, of course, and also increasingly in small numbers in some of the traditional old languages of Africa, like Yoruba, and of course Swahili, in which there's a very large modern literature created as a result of the conscious decision of the independence generation of leadership in Tanzania to take Swahili to create a modern Swahili to be the language of a new country where there were people who spoke many languages, as there are in almost every country in Africa. There are, depending on how you count, between 800 and 1,200, let's say, languages in Africa. There's only 50-something countries in the organization, in the African Union. So divide 50 into... 1,000, and you get an awful lot of languages per country. The leadership in Tanzania decided that they wanted to use an African language, but they couldn't use just one. I mean, they couldn't pick one of the local ones, as it were, because that would have been bad politics. So they picked Swahili, which is a language that had grown up in East Africa as a trading language, and it has a structure that's a sort of Bantu structure. Remember, I mentioned the Bantu migrations. But it also has a lot of loan words from Arabic because of the role of the Omani Arabs in the Swahili coast as rulers, essentially, which goes back to the time of the European Middle Ages. So that means that there's now also a lot to be said about literature, modern literature, novels, poems, as well as about the traditional oral culture, which was being written down by those people who studied oral history. Similarly, our understanding of the sculptural traditions and the other art traditions of Africa has deepened over the last 50 years. We have more and more serious art historical scholarship about Africa, and we have also lots of modern creative artists working in Africa. We have art academies, like the one in my hometown in Kumasi in Ghana, one of whose students, El Anatsui, is now one of the most famous artists in the world. He has two pieces in the Metropolitan Museum in New York, one in the African section and one in the modern art section. They look pretty similar to me, but the point is that he's there, as it were, for two reasons. He's there to represent what's going on in Africa today, and he's also there to represent global art and the global art world. So all this explosion of knowledge means that the brief story I'm now going to tell you about why it took so long to get to the encyclopedia that you have a chance to look at upstairs today is in a way not such a sad story. Because by the time Professor Gates and I got to work on an encyclopedia of Africa and her diaspora, we were sitting on this huge new archive of knowledge. And it was possible for educated people with, roughly speaking, graduate students to go into those libraries and write material, which we could then check and edit and so on, about the questions we thought worth asking in an alphabetically organized subject encyclopedia of Africa. And the sad story is that the conception of the encyclopedia which, whose grandchild is upstairs, the first one that Professor Gates and I concocted, the ancestor of that, the conceptual ancestor of that, was something that W.B. Du Bois thought of in the early 20th century, probably in about 1908 or 9. Professor Gates has reconstructed the history in a way that suggests that part of what inspired him was his knowledge of Britannica and so on, and that's evident in the fact that he called his project the Encyclopedia Africana, Encyclopedia Britannica, Encyclopedia Africana, but also he was particularly inspired, given his sort of cultural nationalist side, by the very evident success of the Encyclopedia Judaica, which appeared in the first decade of the 20th century. And again, he saw that as a kind of... Du Bois often thought of blacks and Jews as having kind of similar cultural political agendas, as it were. And so he was probably inspired in part by that. And he tried over the course of the century, from 1908 till the early 1960s, and in various ways, going to various funders, all the famous funders of African-American projects that you've heard of, the people who funded Gunnar Myrdal, the people, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Phelps Stokes Fund, they all declined to fund Dr. Du Bois. And he, at the end of his life, in his early 90s, he moved to Ghana because he was fed up with McCarthyism, roughly, in the United States. He became, I'm glad to say, a Ghanaian citizen. And, I mean, I'm glad we gave it to him, and I'm glad he took it. He was invited by President Nkrumah, the first president of independent Ghana, to come to set up a secretariat for the Encyclopedia Africana. So at the end of his life, he was beginning this project that he tried for most of his life to begin. And that secretariat had the support of the new Organization of African Unity, and it was an African project. And the result was that project went in a slightly different direction from the thing that he had originally conceived, because that project was going to be an encyclopedia of Africa, like the one that's upstairs, not an encyclopedia of the diaspora, which was the one that he had originally conceived. And the one we originally made, Professor Gates and I, inspired by Dr. Du Bois's original vision, was an encyclopedia of the diaspora. And as I say, I don't think it's in a way so sad that we were delayed in producing the first encyclopedia of the diaspora until the late part of the 20th century, because in the 80 years of delay, all this explosion of knowledge has occurred. That's one reason. And the second reason is that another very important thing occurred in the late 20th century, which was the creation of digital media. And one thing that everybody always knows and says, and I'm afraid it's true, it's not just a stereotype, is that one of the great contributions of Africans to the world, both in the continent and the diaspora, has been in music and dance and the expressive arts. And what better medium than to construct an encyclopedia of those things than a digital medium where you can show people pictures and play them clips of music. And so the first encyclopedia of the diaspora, the first serious encyclopedia of the diaspora, inspired by Dr. Du Bois, and by a conversation that Professor Gates and I and Wole Soyinka, the great Nigerian Nobel laureate, had when Professor Gates and I were students and Professor Soyinka was a visiting lecturer at Cambridge where we were students, inspired by Du Bois, the first Encyclopedia of the Diaspora was produced with Microsoft, and it was the Encarta Africana. It was a digital-born encyclopedia. It was made from scratch for the digital medium, and it's sort of, I think, apt that the first Encyclopedia of Africa and her diaspora was the first made from scratch digital encyclopedia of any major cultural group. But Professor Gates and I and Professor Soyinka are, I'm afraid, creatures of the book. We may think the digital medium has many things to be said for it. We may think that it's terrifically useful for exploring music and the plastic arts and film and painting, and all of which there's very important work, obviously, in the Africa and the diaspora. But for us, despite the fact that Microsoft is a fine institution, we're very grateful for the money they gave us. For us, there had to be a book. And so in conjunction with the development of this digital-born medium, encyclopedia, we made our first encyclopedia of the diaspora, the Encyclopedia Africana. That, like all encyclopedias, has to be redone from time to time, and we took the print Encyclopedia Africana, and after a few years, we took it to Oxford University Press from Perseus, who had funded it originally, and turned it into a large one-volume encyclopedia into a more conventional, perhaps five-volume Encyclopedia of Africa and the Diaspora. And that went very well. That was people like that. And then we realized that inside, buried in this Encyclopedia of the Diaspora in Africa, was an Encyclopedia of Africa. And that if we looked through it and reworked it, and we rewrote about a third of the articles in order to do this, we could create a two-volume Encyclopedia of Africa, and that's the volume that's upstairs. It's the volume that I'm here to recommend to you today as the result of this long process, a process conceived by Dr. Du Bois, but built on the vast growth in knowledge of the black world that has occurred since the early 1960s, and it's particularly starting in the late 60s, both in African-American studies and in African studies, as a result of the complex confluence of cultural movements in the diaspora, independence movements in Africa, and changes in the growth of a kind of anti-racist, non-racist scholarship in Europe and North America. Dr. Du Bois's original thought, which he gave up, but his original thought in creating the Encyclopedia of the Diaspora, was that the truth about black people would bring an end to racism. So now we have the truth. You can tell me what you think about whether racism came to an end. But Dr. Du Bois eventually became persuaded in the mid-century, after he first conceived of this encyclopedia, that was a mistaken idea, and the way racism worked in the world didn't really depend upon people having false beliefs. That the function of racism under capitalism, in his sort of Marxist understanding, meant that the mere correction of people's opinions wasn't going to change anything. But that didn't stop him being interested in the project. So even though he started out with a project whose aim was anti-racist, in the end, he realized, as I realized reading him as a student, that there's something very exciting about assembling a picture, a cyclopedia, a rounded learning about a domain, whether it's the domain of Africa and her diaspora or whether it's the domain of the continent itself. In each case, there's something very exciting what you get, especially now when we live in a world, as I say, in which there's been this explosion of knowledge about the black world. Thanks. So I'm happy to take questions or speeches or personal attacks.
I am a former high school history teacher, and obviously being an American, the topic of slavery is quite powerful in the history agenda. What I'm curious about is what seems to be missing. I don't pretend to be a scholar of African affairs, but what I do know and what seems quite obvious to me is black Africa is not only connected to the Western world, but black Africa, from my understanding, is also connected to the Arab world. And I had found as a teacher that subject matter on black Africa relations with the Arab world are somehow or other missing. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. One of the books I read talked about Dr. Livingston in 19th century Africa, writing about Arab slavery. Mm-hmm. I find that very curious as to why that particular interaction between those two cultures seems to be missing in Western works on Africa.
Well, first of all, Africa, in my conception, is a continent. The first attempts to construct an encyclopedia in the domain that I'm talking about would have been called, Du Bois called his the Africana, always, and that suggests a continent. But many of the antecedents of it would have been called the Encyclopedia of the Negro, and they would have been about, as it were, black Africa. But our encyclopedia is about Africa, which means that there's an article on Egypt, and there's an article on Morocco, and there's an article on Libya, countries which, as you know, have large Arab populations, not exclusively Arab, but certainly very largely Arab populations. And in fact, most of the Arabs in the world are in Africa. There are more Arabs in Africa than there are in Arabia, because Egypt, for example, has a very large population. So, yes, absolutely. More than that, in the article on Mauritania, say, we have to talk about the fact that slavery in Mauritania was only abolished a couple of decades ago, and that it was a kind of racial slavery. That is to say, they were Arab, people thought of themselves as Arab, enslaving people who thought of them, the people they were enslaving, as Africans, black Africans. That notion that, as it were, the real Africans are black is one that you find, you know, not just in the West. For example, I remember once talking to some colleagues in some South African, white South African academic colleagues, and one of them said to me that he had been to Africa. But he was born in Africa. He'd been in Africa all his life. What he meant was he'd been to Senegal. And the real Africa, even for a South African, can sometimes be black Africa. If he'd gone to Egypt, he wouldn't have said he'd gone to Africa. He'd have said he'd gone to Egypt. So that configuration of the world in racial terms, as opposed to geographical terms, that's something that we live with, of course, but it's something that an encyclopedia like this, I think, is bound to challenge, because if you take the continent as the unit of analysis, you have to recognize, as we say in our preface, that it's a multiracial continent, right? I mean, that is, take any conventional notion of what the races are, they're all well represented in Africa today. So, yes, that's important. And as far as slavery goes, it's important to recognize that there's a very significant early slave trade before the European slave trade into the Sahara. That's why you find, it's one of the reasons why you find so many dark-skinned Arabs. It's because their ancestors were African, often African women. Arab men took African women as concubines. And when I say Arab men, I mean of all status. The late king of Morocco had an uncle whose name was El Glaoui, who was darker than me. He was a member of the Moroccan royal family, and he was an Arab. That is, because Arab is a kind of cultural notion for the Arabs themselves. It's not really a color notion. But he obviously had ancestry from further south than Morocco. And the relations between a country like Morocco and a country like Nigeria, or the northern part of Nigeria, Hausaland, those relations you have to talk about, because they go back way before the European colonial period, the reshaping of the empires of Central West Africa in the late European Middle Ages depended upon relations between Arab-speaking peoples from the north and Hausa-speaking people and Malinke-speaking people from the central Sudanic region. We have to talk about that. You have to talk about the slave trade. You have to talk about the fact that the forms of slavery were different in different places. And, of course, you have to talk about the fact that there were African slaves within African societies of tropical Africa. Not just African, not just dark-skinned slaves in Egypt, but dark-skinned slaves in my hometown, in Kumasi. So slavery is a complicated thing, and, of course, in the 18th century, when there was slavery there, there was slavery in lots and lots and lots of places around the world. The reason why we call slaves slaves is because there were a lot of Slavic slaves in medieval Europe. So the word Slav and the word slave have the same etymology. So it's, yeah, but you're right. We have to understand that slavery in Africa is a set of institutions, that it was changed by the Atlantic slave trade in some ways, but that slave trade built on existing African institutions. After all, the opposite theory is very condescending. The opposite theory is that a few Europeans arrived on some boats and changed the total structure of Africa in order to export slaves. the people who, the British, for example, whose castle at Cape Coast in Ghana is one of the great pilgrimage sites of the slave trade today, and where many black people from the diaspora go to it. The slaves, many, many slaves came through there in the 18th and 19th centuries, most the height of the trade in the 18th century. That castle, this big, powerful British castle originally built by the Portuguese, was they paid land rent every year. Every year for a couple hundred years to the chiefs whose land it was on. They weren't there because they had the guns. They were there because they bought the right to be there. And the institutions, when they bought people who were in a something like an enslaved status already. They didn't become slaves when they got to the coast.
Reading about the massacres that took place last weekend in central Nigeria and the hostility between the northern Muslims and the southern Christians makes me wonder, is there rhyme or reason to describe the current boundaries that pervade the landmass of Africa? One thinks of Rwanda, Burundi. One thinks of, were these really imposed by colonials and then the history simply took it over? Or is the Organization of African States giving it some serious thought about reorganizing according to more logical subdivisions?
I want to say just a little thing to correct an impression you have about what happened in Nigeria. The Christians who were attacked were not southern Christians, they were northern Christians. The division of religion in Nigeria between Muslims and Christians and what both Muslims and Christians will call pagans, that division doesn't correspond to North and South in the way that Europeans and North Americans got used to thinking that it did as a result of the Biafran War and the Civil War in Nigeria, which was presented to the world as a war between, for reasons that had to do with engaging the ideological sympathies of Europeans and others. It was represented as a war between the North and the South, but the lead general in the South was a Muslim. And Yorubaland, which is a very interesting and distinctive region in the Nigerian southwest, and a very powerful form of identity, Yoruba identity is one of the great identities of modern Nigeria, though it's largely the product of the 20th century, it's still a very powerful modern identity. That identity is divided. There are about a third of the Yoruba-speaking people of Nigeria are Muslim, a third are Christian, and a third are neither, roughly. So it's very important in understanding what's going on in Nigeria that what's Muslim about the North is that there is a Muslim Hausa elite in the North. The Sultan of Sokoto, the Emir of Kano, as you can tell from their titles, are people who have Muslim-style, Arab-derived notions of political leadership, and they are Muslims. And their subject peoples, the people that they aren't their subject peoples anymore, they're citizens of Nigeria, but the people that that were their subject peoples and the people that they probably think of still as their subject peoples, many of them did not convert to Islam. They didn't bother to convert them. They didn't think they were worth converting. So their first world religion that they came to was when Christian missionaries came, so many of them are Christians. So it's just an important and interesting fact about Nigeria that this our imagination of it as a kind of Muslim North and a Christian South is the reality is more complicated. But on to the question you asked me. The boundaries of Africa south of the Sahara were drawn at the Congress of Berlin under the leadership of basically the Belgian king and Bismarck. And it was really a project of the Belgian kings more than anybody else, and he wanted, and that's why he got the largest, that huge, the largest sort of geographical area in Africa is Zaire, which is the former Belgian Congo, which he got as his private property. It was not a piece of Belgian empire. It was the private property of the king of the Belgians. And it only became a Belgian colony when the behavior of the royal family in ruling that part of the Belgian royal family became so appalling that it became such a scandal that the political leadership in Belgium said to the king, you simply cannot go on doing what you're doing. One of the great early scandals of the early 20th century was the appalling treatment of people in the Belgian Congo by the Belgian authorities under the direct command of the Belgian king. But he had been given that at the Congress of Berlin. I'm not a historian, I never remember dates, but it's around about 1880-something. And you can tell that it's a set of decisions made on a map by guys sitting in Europe because, as you say, many of the lines go straight through important... there are actually places where the line goes straight through a village. And you'll not be surprised to know that the people in the village think of themselves as rather intimately connected and think of the border as a nuisance. The shape of modern Ghana is the result of decisions about the shape of the colonial Gold Coast, followed by the fact that the country next to Ghana was a German colony until the end of the First World War, until 1918, when the Germans colonies were taken away from them as part of their punishment for losing the First World War. That was divided at Versailles between the British and the French. And at independence, the British half of this former German colony decided to join Ghana rather than to become independent with Togo, which is now the part that corresponds to the old French Togoland. So the history of how these, and that's just one example of the weird ways in which the histories of these boundaries got negotiated. So, yeah, on almost every political boundary of the political boundaries that were created at the Congress of Berlin, there are people on both sides who speak the same language as each other, the same African language. Of course, they speak different European languages because some of them were in French colonies and some of them were in British colonies. So Ewe-speaking people in Eastern Ghana, Ewe-speaking people in Eastern Ghana and Ewe-speaking people in Western Togo the ones in Togo speak French because they became a French colony, and the ones in Ghana speak English because it was a British colony. But they all speak Ewe. But you remember I said that, depending on how you count, there's between 800 and 1,200 languages. We can't create a modern state for every linguistic group in Africa for two reasons. One is 1,200 states is just not practical in the modern world. States need to be of a certain size. And the other reason is, even though there are all these languages, they aren't distributed in 1,800 separate blocks. In my hometown, where the traditional people of the region speak one of the Akan languages, Asante Chui, there are people who speak many, many languages. People whose ancestors came from many parts of the country, actually from many parts of the world. You can hear Hindi and Arabic, many dialects of Arabic, Syrian Arabic, Lebanese Arabic, Egyptian Arabic in my hometown. You can hear Hausa, which is originally from northern Nigeria. You can hear Ewe from southern Ghana. You can hear many of the languages of northern Ghana, some of which are only spoken by 10,000 people. So you can't solve the problem by creating boundaries that correspond to the language groups or cultural groups, and you can't solve it by going back to the old political boundaries of pre-colonial Africa, because those political boundaries were themselves the product of internal processes of imperialism. Ghana, modern Ghana, consists mostly of societies which at one time or another were under the imperial control of the Asante nation. Right? They don't want to be reminded of that any more than they want particularly to be reminded of the fact that they were under the British. They want to live in a modern state, and reconfiguring the political boundaries around what they were when the British first tried to take over, which you have to remember was only in the late 19th century, so it's not very long ago in terms of historical memory, wouldn't work. And so what the African Union is trying to do, and I think it's wise, rather than solving this problem by making the boundaries rational, because there's no way to make them rational. If you pick 1800 as your date, you get one lot of boundaries. If you pick 1850, you get another lot. If it's 1750, you get a different lot. Is to weaken the significance of all the borders. And so, for example, ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, has a free movement of labor treaty that says that if a Nigerian wants to work in Ghana, he can just get in the car and go. Now, does that actually work in practice? Yeah. But it's an ideal that's being developed, and also being developed is the idea of reducing customs barriers so that crossing a boundary between, say, Ghana and Togo, and remember that Nigerian, if he wanted to go to Ghana, would have to go through four borders, right? He'd have to go through the Nigeria-Benin border, then the Benin-Togo border, and then the Togo-Ghana border, maybe that's only three. The idea is to reduce the amount of interference in movement, and also to reduce the cost of movement, to stop tariffs so that you don't have to stop at every border and pay some money every time you move a piece of cloth from one place to another or something. That process is ongoing. Border taxes are relatively easy to raise, and states that have a hard time raising money are not very keen to give them up. So there's a political resistance to this. But there's an ideological, I would say, conviction in Africa that, and ECOWAS is just one of the big regional blocks. There's SADC, the Southern African Development Coordination Conference. There's an East African Union as well. These are all attempts to reduce the salience of these boundaries. And so to do really for the problem that you started with, you started me on this long and boring lecture, the growth of the European Union has done for some of the ethnic divisions within the countries of Europe. The growth of the European Union is why it has been easier for the British to have parliaments in Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland. It's because in loosening the boundaries between Britain and France and the rest of Europe, they've been able also to recognize that it's okay for a nationalist sentiment in Wales or Scotland or Ireland to be recognized. And the same thing is true of Catalan autonomy and Basque autonomy in Spain. These are all things that have been made possible by the growth of an overarching European Union. And I think the African Union could, in principle, move in that direction. And then you will have a very diverse range of traditional identities, ranging from something like the Asante identity, which I have because my father was Asante, which is an identity associated with a long-standing imperial state. And up the road from where I grew up, there's a king sitting there whose ancestors have been there for several hundred years. To places like Eastern Nigeria in Igbo culture, which is beautifully described in the novels of Chinua Achebe, which is much more egalitarian. They don't really have kings in his part of Igbo land. Their communities are run by committees of senior people, and you get to be senior by doing things and being respected and earning titles and so on. So there's enormous diversity. And that's another reason why I think turning it all into just a set of states wouldn't work, because some of these forms of identity are the sort of identity that inherit state-like features, and some are more cultural and so on and don't go with traditional political divisions. Igbo land is not a political identity. It's a cultural, linguistic identity, whereas Asante is a political identity and has been, as I say, since the early 18th century. You're worried that if somebody asks me a question, there'll be another 10-minute peroration on some topic. So we have 5 minutes. I promise to stop after 5 minutes. Yes, ma'am. There's a microphone coming.
I guess I've seen in Italy, where I've traveled pretty often, that the European Union has had a terribly suppressive effect on small enterprises in particular. I have very limited knowledge of this, but you've seen, because of the rigidity of the laws, that many wonderful small farmers have had to cut back and sell their beloved sheep because anything over 50 sheep is regulated. And I didn't know if, what a big question about which I know very little, but has the African efforts, can they learn from that something? It really has destroyed a tremendous amount of local cultural richness that I've seen in Italy.
Yes. I mean, the standard complaint of many Europeans about the European Union has been that in following the impulse of modern bureaucracies to create, through administration, uniformity of rules, they've kind of destroyed some of the what's interesting about the particularly the rural cultures, as you say, and of Europe. And being bureaucrats, their response to that has been to create special bureaucracy whose job is to try and help people that they've ruined the lives of. And so there are things like the Highland and Islands Development Board in Scotland, whose job is to help little farmers who are having a hard time struggling with the European regulations to maintain their farms. I'm sort of mocking it, but it's not funny if you're a crofter on an island off the west coast of Scotland. But we don't have this problem in Africa because the African Union hasn't anything like the bureaucratic structure or ambition. If you think it was hard to persuade the politicians of the nation states of Western Europe to grant sovereignty, to transfer elements of sovereignty to Brussels, I can assure you that it's been infinitely harder to persuade elites which have only recently come to be national elites for the reason you said, the nations are relatively new and the borders are relatively arbitrary. It's been very hard to persuade them to give stuff up. And you can see this in the contrast between the European Convention on Human Rights, for example, and the African, the Banjul Declaration on Human Rights, both of which I strongly endorse. They're wonderful. But the Banjul one just simply doesn't give the secretariat in Banjul in the Gambia the kinds of powers in relation to the states that the European Convention on Human Rights gives to the court in Strasbourg. So so basically the problem of governments in Africa is mostly not a problem of over-governance. It's usually a problem of the weakness of states, not states that are too strong, but states that are too weak to do the things that citizens need, keep the roads, keep the money working, police crime, and so on. And if that's true of the nation states, it's a fortiori true of the African Union, which has very, very weak, very, very few coercive powers. And part of the tradition of the Organization of African Unity, which morphed into the African Union, as the EEC morphed into the EU, was that everything was done by unanimity. And that gives you, if you've got 50 states, a requirement of unanimity means that you make very few binding decisions.
I guess since an encyclopedia is sort of a people's places things compendium, but I know that a lot of your work is sort of philosophy and an aspect of identity and ethics. How do you feel this compendium of people, places, things of Africa, which is important, how do you think that plays into the ideas of identity and sort of the philosophy aspect of what you do?
Well, the short answer is that, and you'll be glad to hear that, the short answer is that having thought a lot about identity over the course of my scholarly life, I'm less inclined to worry about whether an identity is kind of authentic than some people are. Because I think all identities are kind of made things, and we make them up to do jobs, and sometimes they do a good job for us and sometimes they don't. But it's not true that there's a contrast to be made, a sensible contrast to be made between, as it were, authentic identities and inauthentic ones. There are inauthentic people, but there are not inauthentic identities. So when we concocted the idea for the Encyclopedia Africana, or rather when we borrowed Du Bois's idea and went looking for support for it, many people said to us, but aren't you famous for saying that race is an invention? I said, yes. And they said, but then isn't the diaspora an invention? And I said, yes, but the inventions need encyclopedias too. After all, the United States is an invention. Does that mean we shouldn't have American encyclopedias of the United States? I don't think so. So part of what you do in an encyclopedia that's sensitive to that thought is you have articles that are about this process. And so we have articles that deal with, for example, there's this concept of the tribe, which many people use in thinking about Africa. And when I say many people, I don't just mean many people outside Africa. It's a term that you'll hear all the time in African languages. I mean, in African conversations, whether in English or French or Portuguese or Arabic, you'll hear a word that means something like that. But they're very diverse, these things that we call tribes. Some of them correspond to pre-colonial nations like Asante, and they're more like nationalities. Some of them are, as I said, cultural things like Igbo tribe. The Igbo tribe is not a group of people who were ever politically united in a state. They have shared languages, not the same language. Igbo varies from place to place, and Chinua Achebe once told me that in one of the dialects of Igbo, Igbo means stranger, I think. So I may have misremembered that, but I remember him saying something of that sort. So one of the things you have to talk about is that if you use ethnonyms, as we like to call them when we're being polite, for people in Africa, you have to realize that there are very different kinds of ethnonyms. Some of them refer to large cultural areas. Some of them are purely the result of colonial invention, like the Hutu-Tutsi distinction in Rwanda and Burundi, which is the result of colonial fantasies, racial fantasies about the Africans and how those populations came together. But some of them correspond to, as I say, political identities that are very old. The Asante is an oldish identity because, as I say, the Asante state really comes together in the early part of the 18th century, 1702, 1703, something like that. But it's the successor state to earlier Akan states in the region, again, people speaking related languages. So statehood and identity have been associated in this region for a very long time. But if you talk to Basawa, the Bush, I don't know what the right word is in English for them now, but people used to be called the Bushmen in the Kalahari Desert in Botswana, you know, they have identities, but they don't think of them, until recently, they haven't thought of themselves as one thing. It was other people who came and saw them and saw that they looked rather alike and that they had similar, forms of hunter-gathering and so on, who sort of thought of them as a group. Are Native Americans one thing, or are they many things? And if they're many things, shouldn't we notice that different Native American groups had very different forms of politics, different forms of ecology and economy, and therefore different histories of identity? Well, I think we should. That's true in Africa too. I don't object to the word tribe as long as the people who use it know that it refers to a bunch of different things, and you'll be very confused if you don't realize that. You'll make mistakes in understanding what the significance is of what people's ethnic identities are in Africa if you don't understand that these names work in different ways and have different histories. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.